You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Temple Grandin has a doctorate in animal behavior, and she's been credited with revolutionizing animal movement systems. She also happens to be autistic, but unlike most people with that condition, she is not remote, inaccessible, or obviously unable to function. She's written in the past about what autism reveals about how animals think, and now in her latest book, she considers how understanding the emotional lives of animals can help humans and animals interact. The book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Temple Grandin back to the show. It's always a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here.
How does your being autistic help you understand animals in a way that other people can't?
Well, I'm a visual thinker. I don't think in language, and animals do not have verbal language. The world of the animal, it's a sensory-based world. They think in pictures. They think in smell whiffs. They think in little sounds. It's detailed sensory memories.
And when we're talking about animals here, are we talking about mammals mostly?
Well, mammals and birds, dogs, cats, horses, all mammals and birds, basically.
You begin the book by referring to the Bramble Report. What did the Bramble Report call for in animal welfare?
Well, one of the things is the five freedoms, like freedom from fear, freedom from discomfort, the ability to perform natural behaviors. You know, that was the first report to look at sort of how does the animal, experiencing the situation.
When was it issued?
That was a good 20 years or so ago. And, before everybody just thought, well, if the animal's healthy and he's producing, then he's fine. Yes, health is an important part of animal welfare, but it's not the only part of animal welfare.
So has that led to changes in thinking in the way we deal with domesticated animals, for example?
Well, one of my big concerns is dogs that are home alone all day. Because in the first chapter of Animals Make Us Human, Katherine Johnson and I talk about the fear, the core emotions, fear, rage, separation anxiety, and then goal-directed seeking behavior. And separation anxiety is the behavior that puppies do when they're separated from the mother. And some dogs have a really hard time being locked up in an apartment all day. You know, to give a dog a good life today requires a lot of work taking them out. And if your dog is licking his paw or chewing up the house or whining all day, you need to do something about it. Maybe get another dog. Maybe leave him in a neighbor where the neighbor's home during the day. Take him to a doggy daycare. Or maybe you might be allowed to take him to work.
What did you learn about domestic dogs from studying wolves in the wild?
Well, wolves, of course, are genetically dogs with the same genetics. They can interbreed. And in the dog chapter, we talk about that wolf families out in the wild are families. You know, you have maybe five different domestic dogs together. That's what's called a forced pack. And then you'll get those dominance hierarchies, where in the more natural situation, it's like a family. And maybe a better way to look at working with your dog is you're his parent, not a big, domineering master.
Well, the dog trainer Cesar Millan says that dogs need their owner to be an alpha dog.
Well, the thing is, Cesar, some of the things that Cesar says are wrong, but there's certain kinds of dogs that he works very well with. And I've told people with animal behavior to just shut the sound off and watch what he does. And with some of the Rottweilers and then pit bulls and those kind of dogs, he works very, very well with those dogs. But when it comes to separation anxiety or fear-based behaviors. Some of the fear-based behaviors, he doesn't know what to do with those. He'll just force the dog into something. I bought 2 years of his show, first 2 years, and looked at the kind of dogs he worked well with, the kind of dogs he did not work well with. And you go back to the core emotional systems, the fear-based dogs, the separation-based anxiety dogs he was bad with, and with some of these confident, aggressive dogs, he worked really well. And I've watched some of his more recent shows, and he's kind of getting kinder and gentler.
Since dogs are pack animals and are sociable, is it better to have more than one?
Well, dogs need to have companionship. Now, I'm realizing in a New York apartment that having more than one may not be the best thing, so people can also be their companions. But it's important for dogs to get socialized with other dogs. It's also very important for dogs to get socialized to toddlers, because the animal's a visual thinker. And that little person's a different picture than the big person. And if the puppy doesn't get socialized to toddlers, you might get into some dangerous prey drive behavior. And a lot of problems we have today with dog bites is due to not being socialized to people and not being socialized to other dogs. Dogs that are reared by themselves, that haven't learned to socialize with other dogs, can often be vicious fighters.
we assume that certain breeds are better and more adaptable than others, not just to socializing, but also to being left alone. Is that true?
Well, different breeds, and there's a lot of variation within a breed. I mean, some dogs are going to handle being home alone a whole lot better than others. The separation anxiety trait does have some genetics behind it. There's an old experiment that was done years ago in France with quail, and they were able to breed high fear and low fear quail and high separation anxiety and low separation anxiety quail.
So birds have these same experiences?
Yes. Yes, those same traits. And fact,
they don't bite the furniture when you leave them alone in the apartment,
well,
do they?
They'll pick out their feathers. There's some very bad problems with parrots pulling out feathers.
So pretty much it's all the same kind of thing, whether they bite the furniture or... In the case of cats, when they scratch the furniture, are they doing pretty much the same thing? Or are they just simply doing what it looks like they're doing, which is stretching and preening their claws?
No, cats don't scratch furniture from separation anxiety. Cats have social needs, but a cat is a much lower maintenance pet, and they handle being home alone a whole lot better than a dog does.
So dogs have to learn to control their anger? And frustration?
Well, some dogs, I mean, some of the little toy breeds are really needy. And I think you have to look at what is your dog doing when you're home alone. If he's licking his paw and making a sore on his paw or rubbing hair off, there's too many dogs being locked up in crates all day. One lady said to me, well, why has my poodle rubbed the hair off his head? Yeah, you've got a separation anxiety problem. You know, other dogs will sleep all day and they may be fine.
Now, should I assume that it doesn't matter whether the dog is a purebred or a mutt? These things will happen either way?
Yeah, that's really not the
issue. Purebreds are not more high-strung?
It depends upon the breed. And, you know, some dogs handle it better than others, but there's a tremendous amount of variation between dogs. I mean, let's look at Labrador. You've got that lanky, frisky Labrador that's ball crazy, wants to chase the Frisbee all the time. That dog's going to go crazy if it's locked up all day. You've got a heavy-set, calmer kind of lab that, you know, is less active, you know, may tolerate it a bit better.
My guest is Temple Grandin, who's written with her longtime collaborator, Katherine Johnson, another book called, this one is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. You write about Dr. Jacques Pangstip. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, that's right.
It's a Dutch name. He's a neuroscientist who studies animal emotions. What are the blue ribbon emotions he talks about?
No, those are the four core emotions of fear that motivates animals to get away from predators, rage or anger, separation anxiety, which he calls panic, and seeking, that's goal-directed behavior. Those are the four core emotions, and then there's three other emotions that are sex, play, and mother-young nurturing behavior. And the thing is, the brain circuits for these things have all been mapped. But the problem is, for years, it's been hidden over in the neuroscience literature. One of the big problems we have in science is neuroscience has their journals and their meetings, veterinarian has their journals and their meetings, psychologists their journals and their meetings, and nobody communicates.
Well, should I assume that animals are happier in natural environments? We were talking about dogs being cooped up in apartments. How far do we want to give them freedom?
Well, dogs need to have companionship, other dogs and other people. And, you know, there's dogs that live in the city and they're just fine. You know, if the dog's with you all the time, he's fine. He's not going to get separation anxiety. Now, it's important to train dogs to tolerate some time being away from you. They need to learn that.
But what about other animals? For example, there's been a lot of talk about how we treat farm animals and whether we should put animals in zoos and whether animals should be in circuses. You have a whole thing about what you call stereotypies, which manifest themselves as a result of unnatural situations.
Well, they're bad environments, because you can have an environment that's a good environment, keeps your animal occupied, and it may not be natural. You know, I think a lot of people who live in New York think that they get in a great environment, and it's certainly not natural, you know, to live in the concrete and in the cities. You've got to, you know, some of these stereotypies is repetitive behavior, very similar to what I did, you know, as an autistic child.
It's like what we see with autistic people.
That's
or
right.
People with OCD?
Well, it's more like what you see with people with autism, you know, the repetitive behavior, things like rocking. Some people
twirling.
Even twirling. Start damaging themselves.
Headbanging.
You know, headbanging is just totally abnormal behavior. And in an animal like the gerbil, he may be digging and digging and digging and digging, And people go, oh, let's give him more dirt to dig in. But the reason why he's digging is he has an instinctual fear of aerial predators, and he needs something to hide under. And you give him something to hide under, then he's not going to keep on digging. Where the polar bear pacing around and around and around, he has nothing to seek. That's an animal. It's a real high seekers, constantly walking around and exploring its environment.
Well, we see the polar bear do that in the zoo. In fact, you see an awful lot of zoo animals walking or pacing obsessively. That's all stereotypies?
Yeah, that's all stereotypies, and we need to be working on preventing those stereotypies. And how you go about preventing it is going to depend upon the species of the animal. The gerbil needs hiding places. So you give him things he can hide under, then he's going to stop the stereotypic digging. Polar bear, you've got to give it a lot of things to do. In fact, right here in New York, they've put all kinds of barrels in his pool for him to play with. And
do stereotypies ever occur in the wild?
You can get a little bit of it, but the kind of hardcore stereotypies where an animal is spending 80% of its time or half of its time of its day doing stereotypies, that does not occur in the wild. I mean, if you've got stereotypic behavior going on, you've got an environment that's forced the nervous system to go into an abnormal mode of operation, and it's not acceptable as far as I'm concerned.
But you suggested that we can make the animals feel like they're in the wild, or at least eliminate some of the things that will lead them to this abnormal behavior simply by recognizing how they live in the wild?
Well, you have to recognize what's driving the stereotypic behavior. Okay, the dog that's home alone, that's the separation anxiety emotion. The gerbil's digging due to fear. The polar bear's pacing because he has nothing to seek.
What about those big cats that look so unhappy in the zoo?
Well, the cats need lots of things to seek and play with. In fact, I went to one of the zoos here, and they had strung up a cable across the zoo and had, like, giant cat toys. They could bounce up and down, let kitty kill a box of meat and eat it. It was just like playing with a house cat, and the tiger thought that was really fun. You've got to give them things to do. These are intelligent animals.
So the zoos are figuring these things out finally.
Yeah, zoos are getting a whole lot better about this.
And do you consult with zoos?
Yes, I have. One of the things I've worked with zoos was training antelopes to cooperate with their vaccinations and with their medical treatments.
Antelopes?
Antelopes. And when we worked on this research, and this is all explained in our book, Animals Make Us Human, nobody thought it would be possible to train antelopes. They thought, well, they're just too flighty. Well, we trained them. It took 10 days to teach an antelope to tolerate a door sliding up and down. You had to do it very carefully and slowly.
People are upset by the way some animals in circuses are trained. Do circuses, are they okay environments for animals?
It depends upon how it's run. I think teaching animals tricks and things like that needs to be totally done with positive methods. One good method that we do talk about in the book is clicker training, where you pair the sound of a click with food, and you can teach an animal to do all kinds of tricks and all kinds of things with clicker training.
My guest is Temple Grandin, who is a professor at Colorado State University, the author of 5 books, including the classic autism memoir, Thinking in Pictures. Her latest, written with Katherine Johnson, is called Animals Make Us Human. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Temple Grandin. Her latest book, written with the help of Katherine Johnson, is called Animals Make Us Human. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Can you tell us about the squeeze machine that you invented?
Well, when I got into puberty, I started having horrible anxiety attacks. I mean, it was like being in a constant state of fear. When I do autism talks, I tell people, imagine if we locked up this building and just filled it up full of poisonous snakes. You'd be in a constant state of fear all the time. My nervous system was like looking for those poisonous snakes even when they were not there. And I went out to my aunt's ranch, and the next-door neighbors were working cattle in the squeeze shoe, which is a device for holding cattle for veterinary work. And I noticed that sometimes the cattle kind of relaxed from the pressure. So I went and tried out the squeeze shoe. And the pressure calmed me down. So then I built this squeeze chute-like thing I could get into to calm down my nervous system. Many individuals on the autism spectrum will seek pressure, like get under sofa cushions. One girl put big, heavy bags of dog food on herself because that pressure is calming.
Would this work with any animal? Would an anxious dog benefit from going through a squeeze machine?
Well, you can actually, you know, just squeeze a dog around the waist. There's also a vest you can get called an anxiety wrap that applies pressure, you know, to the dog. Now, you want to make sure you only leave this on for no longer than 20 minutes. Same thing with an autistic kid. It's 20 minutes on, then you take it off for a while. If you leave it on too long, the nervous system habituates.
There's a big debate in the world of autism over whether you should give these kids any kind of medication. But what about with animals? Would you recommend giving anti-anxiety medication to a dog or to a cat?
It shouldn't be your first thing you do. Let's try doing other things like giving it a better social environment, giving it a whole lot more exercise, more interaction with people, interaction with other dogs. And then if that doesn't work, there's some animals that are so messed up with things like separation anxiety where they may need to have a little bit of Prozac. But that shouldn't be the first thing that you do.
It's widely believed that you can't train a cat, but you don't think that's necessarily true.
Well, you can train a cat, but the thing is, dogs are very social, and they will do things because they want to please you. They'll do anything you want just for stroking and praise. Cats, you have to use food motivation in order to train them. They're very, very trainable with clicker training.
There's a cartoon in this week's New Yorker of a dog talking to a cat, and the dog says, so they ask you to sit, you sit. They ask you to roll over, you roll over. What's the prob? And dogs and cats are so different. Cats will not – although I have seen cats trained in circuses to do things.
You can train cats, but you have to use food motivation. You teach the animal the sound of the clicker is going to be, you know, associated with getting a food treat. Then you can use operant conditioning methods to train them. But it's food motivation. It's not social motivation.
We are also, many people, close to horses. They don't live in our homes as dogs and cats do. Do horses have the same kind of relationship with their owners that cats and dogs do?
Well, horses have some of that wanting to please you, too. Not as much as the dog has, but they do have some of that trait.
That's why they nuzzle you sometimes.
But the dog, really, the thing that's different compared to all the other animals we work with is dogs really want to please you.
And you say that horses are high-fear animals. What makes them high-fear?
Well, they're a prey species animal, where the dog and the cats are a predator. Horse survives in the wild by running away from things that are going to eat it and kicking. Cattle also is a prey species animal. And prey species animals as a species are higher fear than the predator animals. But I want to emphasize there's a tremendous amount of variation within dog breeds, between dog breeds. And another thing I'm very concerned about are all the breeding problems with animals, with all the hip problems in dogs and behavior problems, some of it caused by nervous system problems. Farm animals that grow fast have leg problems.
Horses as well.
Well, there's some people.
We bred horses to run faster, and they have sometimes they become neurotic, don't they?
Well, and they also have fine bones that break easily. I think it's very important with any animal, whether it's a farm animal or a pet animal, that we breed animals where the skeleton is sound and the nervous system is in good condition.
You say that horses have hyper-specific memories, that they remember abuse and bad experiences?
Well, dogs do the same thing. Okay, you need to work with animals to avoid fear memories. Like a common fear memory that dogs will get is, you know, ladies are good, guys are bad. But some of these memories can be very specific.
Because some guys have kicked them something?
That's right. Or if somebody raises their hand, they cower because they associate that with getting hit. But it can be very specific. Like in Animals Make Us Human, I describe a horse that was afraid of white saddle pads. But he was only afraid of naked white saddle pads. In other words, there's no saddle on top. As soon as you put the saddle on top of the saddle pad, it's a different picture. You see, it's a picture. It was something that the animal either was hearing or seeing right at the moment that the bad thing happened.
So how do you train them to get past that fear?
Well, sometimes you can train them to get past it, but the problem is you can't erase the fear memory, you know, completely. And if the animal has real high-strung genetics, like an Arab horse, you know, an Arab horse you want to train on really gently, but let's say you really traumatize it badly, it can be very hard to retrain it.
Do you believe that horse whisperers really do communicate with the animals?
They communicate with the animals. They do a poor job of explaining it. And the animal will do a lot of little body postures, like, you know, is it quivering? Are the eyes starting to bug out? Get the whites of the eyes show? Where are the ears pointing to? And the horse whisperers pick up on these things, and they get an emotion, and they're not able to explain it. They're very good at reading the animal's body language.
Now, I'm getting the message from you that you believe only in positive reinforcement when you're dealing with animals. Is negative reinforcement ever a good idea?
Well, the one place, unfortunately, where you might have to do negative reinforcement is prey drive. You have a dog that's a cat killer, a sheep killer. I went into one of the big Barnes & Noble stores and I pulled out every dog training book and to look up some of the really bad behavior problems, especially in the positive books, on some very severe aggression problems and things like cat killing. And those subjects were just avoided. But when it comes to teaching an animal a new task, you know, teach it a trick, teach it to do something, that should all be done totally, totally positive.
My guest is Temple Grandin, who's written with Katherine Johnson, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've done most of your research on livestock, cows and pigs. How has your work helped you create better environments for those animals to be raised in? Are we starting to see real changes? Because we keep on hearing about cows being allowed once again to graze on grass instead of being stuck in these tight environments. Some people are objecting to us filling them with antibiotics and hormones.
Well, one of the big problems is what I call pushing the biological system too hard. And we do it with pet animals, too, when we over-select for stupid appearance traits. We get the bulldog with such a big head and such a smashed-in nose that he can't breathe and they can't have their babies normally. So you take all these, you know, grain or antibiotics or whatever, and you push that animal too hard with it, you get into problems where the animal's biology starts to really suffer. The dairy cow has been bred to milk, 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 more and more milk. Well, now we've got a skinny dairy cow that has a lot of problems with lameness. And I have a lot of problems with pushing the biology to the point where your animal's falling apart. And it can be a farm animal, and it can be a pet animal, too.
And you say that they experience fear, and many of the people who deal with them don't realize that.
Well, so my biggest amount of work with cattle has been with handling, designing handling facilities, designing facilities at slaughter plants. And by having better engineered equipment, you can greatly improve things. But you also have to have the management to go with it. And you saw there's been horrible videos on TV of abuse of cattle. And I've worked with plants on developing a numerical scoring system where you count if it fell down. You put numbers on things. And this has resulted in some really good improvements. In 1999, McDonald's and Wendy's started using this. Now, there's been two terrible videos out on the Internet of absolutely awful plants. And unfortunately, those plants were, one of them in particular, was outside the audit system. And the other problem you have is they act good when you're there. So the big thing I'm working on right now is video auditing. And one of our major companies, Cargill, one of the biggest meat companies, now has video cameras all throughout the stunning area and the handling area, and auditors over the Internet can tune in anytime and look.
One thing you point out is stressful to cattle is the constant regrouping that they experience. What's regrouping, and why is it a source of stress for them?
Well, that's more of a problem with the dairy heifers. Let's say small ranchers sell their cattle. You know, one rancher's got 20 cattle, another rancher's got 10 cattle. He sold down at the local auction, and they get mixed together.
That makes them uncomfortable?
Well, every time you mix animals, they're going to fight. And one of the ways to get rid of that problem is really big groups. You mix 200 cattle together, they set up social hierarchies at different parts of the pen. You don't get as much conflict than five animals mixed together in a small pen. That can sometimes be scorpions in a bottle, especially with pigs.
Now, let's talk about pigs for a moment, because I have heard many times that they are very, very intelligent, and they're among the best pets that you could ever have, if you have the room anyway. Is that true?
Well, the problem with the regular domestic pig is they get absolutely huge. They can get up to, 500, 600 pounds, and if you get the small the small miniature pigs, they still get extremely big. And they can get up to 250 pounds or so. So people put them on really strict diets to try to keep them from getting fat, and they get very, very grouchy when they're put on that stricter diet. I would recommend a dog or a cat for a pet.
Rather than a pig?
No. The reason why I don't recommend having a pig is the problem of their size. And keeping them, and the only way to stop them from getting really big is to put them on a draconian diet, which makes the animal really unhappy.
But so when we are raising them on factory farms, we're doing everything bad for a pig.
Well, the thing is the pig goes off to the slaughter plant before he gets to be 500 pounds. Nobody's slaughtering 500-pound market pig.
A caller wants to know if you think animals should have freedom from untimely death. Do you support raising animals and killing them for food?
I do. I eat meat. I have no intention of giving it up. In fact, I've got I get hypoglycemic if I don't eat animal protein, but I feel very, very strong. We've got to give that animal a good life. And beef cattle, and I want to differentiate between beef cattle and dairy cattle. Beef cattle, all of them, both the commercial ones and the natural ones and the organic ones, are raised out on pastures. And some of the animals go into feedlots, some under very good conditions, some under conditions that need to be improved. But we've got to give animals a decent life, and then when they go to the slaughterhouse, have no more stress than they'd have going into the veterinary chute.
What about chickens? Do they have the same blue ribbon emotions that dogs and pigs have?
Yes, they would.
So are free-range chickens better off than caged chickens?
It depends, because if you totally get rid of the cages, you get some other problems with cannibalism and pecking. They may have to change some of the genetics to solve that problem. The thing that's important is giving the chicken things that it emotionally needs. And one of the things it needs is it needs a private nest box. Because when chickens live in the wild, the chicken that lays her eggs in the clearing, the fox is going to eat her. She wants to get in some secluded place where she's hidden to lay her eggs. She needs a private nest box, and she needs perching for leg strength. Those are two things that they definitely need to have.
On the other hand, you recommend that farms and slaughterhouses have glass walls. Why?
I think as an industry, we need to be opening up the door and showing what we do. I've taken a lot of people through some very well-run slaughter plants, some of the big ones, and I have them just watch the cattle going up the chute, and they're going, oh, they just quietly walk up the chute. I said, that's the way it's supposed to work. You know, and there's all these horrid videos out on the Internet, and I've put some YouTube videos up to show some of my systems. You can access them by typing in Temple Grandin Cattle.
So why do you think so many people raising livestock keep doing things that don't work or that end up causing harm to their animals?
Well, people just get into pushing, for money. You know, it gets to be the almighty dollar. It's the same greed emotion that got the whole Wall Street economy into so much trouble.
So it costs more to treat livestock humanely?
No, they're just pushing it, and some of it's short-sighted and kind of stupid. I mean, we've pushed the dairy cow now to the point where she can give all these gallons of milk, but she only lasts 2 years. It takes you 2 years to raise a heifer up to become a cow, and then you only milk her for 2 years? I don't know how they do their counting. It's just stupid. It's single-minded thinking. It's the same thing that's getting dog breeders into trouble, breeding for more of the same appearance trait to the point where we have the hips falling off of breed after breed after dog.
German Shepherds.
Not just German Shepherds. Rottweilers, Labradors, two-year-old Labrador. I had a lady tell me about in a book signing. Severe hip problems.
Is there a connection between how animals are treated and how content they are and the quality of the meat or the milk or the eggs?
Yes, there are some relationships. The last 5 minutes in the slaughterhouse when you handle pigs is very, very critical to meat quality. In fact, my students just done a study that shows if you put electric prods and things on pigs at that point, it raises their lactate, which messes up their meat. Calm animals that are not afraid of people, gain more weight. Sows that are not afraid of people have more piglets. Good stockmanship pays, and there needs to be a lot more emphasis on good stockmanship. Too often people just want the thing, the magic feed, the magic supplement, the computer or whatever, and they don't want to do the management to go along with it.
On the other hand, the public has been more involved and interested in this. Are you heartened by the fact that they've been paying more attention to their food comes from?
I think there's things that need to be changed. And I'm a very practical person. And I can see the organic and the natural niches, getting bigger. It's never going to be the whole industry. It's just too expensive. We still are going to have large-scale commercial farming or what people call factory farming. There's things we need to improve, like, for example, getting rid of the sow gestation stalls where they can't turn around. I think those commercial pigs are probably still going to be on concrete, but we can give them some straw just to root around in and some roughage to eat. Just read in one of our Feedstuffs magazines about feeding sows a lot more roughage, and that's really good.
You point out that Jane Goodall became an ethnologist through the back door. Are you concerned that there aren't enough people going to the field of animal behavior?
I'm concerned about that. Who's going to be the next Jane Goodall? It's... We need people.
And we need a Louis Leakey pushing her into doing this.
Well, and we need to have people working in the field. One of the big problems we have on many policy things is you've got people making policy that that have no experience with what's happening on the ground. And it isn't just animal issues. It's many issues. The Internet has tend to polarize the radical right and the radical left because they get on there and make big noises on the Internet. We need to get practical people to find out what's going on the ground to, figure out how to do things and make policy that's going to work, whether it's animal issues or it's some other issue. And I'm very, very concerned about this.
Temple Grandin's latest book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.